Yemeni army announces a military operation in the UAE. Emirati officials report explosions and fire in fuel tankers and the international airport in Abu Dhabi. Iran rejects the U.S. top diplomat's comments about the ongoing talks to revive the JCPOA. It says the deadlines announced by Washington are fabricated. And also in the headlines, a senior Russian official saying that the U.S. and NATO have overstepped Moscow's red lines by their gradual invasion into Ukraine.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us.
Top story, the Yemeni army is saying it's launched a military operation deep inside the United Arab Emirates. The announcement comes after UAE reported two fire incidents in the capital, Abu Dhabi. Officials said that three fuel tankers exploded near storage facilities in the city, killing three people and wounding six. There was also a fire at a construction site at the Abu Dhabi International Airport. The UAE says initial investigations show the fires were possibly caused by drones. The Yemeni military conducts regular retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia over its aggression against Yemen, but attacks against the UAE that's fighting alongside the Saudis have been rare, and this days after the UAE-backed forces joined a key battle in Yemen's Ma'arib. On that note, I talked to activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Okaiti, who joined us from the Yemeni capital, for the latest information about the Yemeni army's attack against several sites in the UAE. Let's hear what he had to say.
Today attack, was new about it, that the United Arab Emirates actually has admitted this attack in the first minute after Yemeni army has conducted this attack. And we can see that Yemeni army has warned, and some officials here in Sana'a has warned in the last 3 days, United Arab Emirates, if it's not going to stop its attack against Yemen, because they have actually resumed their airstrike against the Yemeni civilians, especially in Shabwa region. And as well yesterday, they have targeted Damar city, targeting some mobile station on some mountains in Damar city, central Yemen. But at the end, they haven't actually respected the warning from Yemen that United Arab Emirates will become a target. And we're going to see that from the announcement from United Arab Emirates that was released a minute ago, they have said that three fuel tanker were set on fire because what they say of a suspect drone near ADNOC oil firm. And as well, they have announced that the other attack was in a construction site in Abu Dhabi Airport. This actually means that this attack is just a message to United Arab Emirates, because Yemeni forces could actually have targeted the oil firm itself. They could have targeted the oil refinery in that area, and as well they could have targeted United Arab Emirates Abu Dhabi Airport, not only the construction site. But I believe they still try to give United Arab Emirates a message to stop their attack. If they don't stop their attack against Yemen, if they are not going to support their mercenary in Yemen, if they are not going to withdraw all their forces and stop supporting any forces loyal to them, I believe that the coming attack, it will come directly on Abu Dhabi Airport, and it will come directly in United Arab Emirates oil refinery, either in the sea or in Abu Dhabi and the surrounding area of Abu Dhabi.
The U.S. has warned that time is running out for Iran to revive the 2015 agreement. Iran's foreign minister says the deadlines announced by Washington are fabricated.
Regarding some fabricated deadlines, I have to tell you that the current U.S. president, his foreign policy team, his negotiators in Vienna know that if JCPOA is alive today, that's because of the Islamic Republic of Iran, not the U.S.
Speaking of the U.S. Adopting Plan B in case the talks fail, Khatibzadeh urged Washington to focus on Plan A and speed up efforts to salvage the JCPOA. The spokesman said that what has remained is crucial matters and special political decisions that the U.S. has to make. He said should this happen, the sides will be moving a step toward a sustainable agreement. Now, those comments came as the eighth round of negotiations aimed at reviving the accord is underway in the Austrian capital. The head of the Iranian delegation, Ali Bagherekani, and other parties to the deal are now back to the negotiating table after consultations with their capitals. Well, I just talked to our Vienna correspondent, Humay Lisfi. for an update regarding the ongoing talks underway between Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA. Here's what you had to say.
Yesterday, we had two working groups working on the weekend here, both on the issue of sanctions lifting and also on implementation or sequencing, which refers to the steps, the practical steps that need to be taken both by Iran and the Americans to go back to their commitments. And Iran, as we've said time and again before, has stressed that it would only go back to its commitments after the effective and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. So it's also, of course, been calling for verification and guarantees. There have been various proposals and ideas on how the Americans could give guarantees to the Iranian side that they will not withdraw from the deal again, they will not impose or reimpose sanctions that violate the deal. It looks like there's an agreement on the principle of guarantees, also on verification, how the Americans can verify effective sanctions removal. You know, yesterday, Enrique Mora, the EU coordinator, in a tweet said that success of these talks is still, quote, uncertain, but he has to commend the efforts that the sides are making to make it successful. And he was referring to the fact that on a Sunday they were still here, the expert working group working on the issues on the table, sit on the table that need work, technically, legally. So there is, it looks like, a will and determination to make it happen. Also, Joseph Borrell, the EU High Representative, said that he believes an agreement can be reached here. The Russians have expressed optimism that it can be reached even by early February. There is a determination to make it happen. We'd have to see if the important political decisions at the higher levels are made to actually have the JCPOA restored.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says that the implementation of Tehran-Beijing Comprehensive Partnership Agreement is a strategic victory for Iran. Ali Champani says the pact enters the implementation phase while the U.S. continues its unilateralism and maximum pressure campaign to deprive Iran of economic interactions with the world. Days ago, Iran and China announced the enactment of a landmark 25-year collaboration agreement, and that was after an official visit by Iranian Foreign Minister Amin Abdullahian to the Asian country. The agreement was signed in 2021 to boost the economic and the political ties between the two countries.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday.
The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights, and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
Now, Iran's growing ties with China are part of the Islamic Republic's look to the east policy. That also involves bringing together other U.S. adversaries like Russia, that Iran also has a long-term deal with. Hostile U.S. policies, including sanctions, have been a major reason for countries like Russia, China, and Iran to get closer. And to soften the blow of the sanctions, these countries are all moving toward de-dollarization.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an East-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions. Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Now, one of the icons of popular resistance in the occupied West Bank has died after being critically wounded by Israeli forces. Sheikh Soleiman Al-Hathlain was run over by a vehicle belonging to Israeli forces earlier this month. The incident took place in the village of Al-Kher, south of the West Bank. Hathlain's brother says that he was deliberately targeted. The 65-year-old activist was a staunch opponent of Israeli settlement activities and occupation in the Palestinian territories. Around 700,000 Israelis live in settlements built since the 1960s of an occupation of the Palestinian land of the West Bank and East Al-Quds. They are illegal under international law, and several UN Security Council resolutions have condemned such construction activity. In the meantime, Israeli aggression against Palestinians comes in a variety of forms and takes on new shapes from time to time. Most recently, bulldozers under heavy security protection from the army stormed into a Bedouin Palestinian village, all in the name of a tree planting project. But that, as expected, drew a fierce reaction from local residents and plunged the region into fresh escalation. Let's take a closer look.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Nakab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume.
Moscow says that the U.S. and NATO have overstepped Russia's red lines by their gradual invasion into Ukraine.
NATO is a weapon of confrontation. And this weapon of confrontation with each year started to get closer and closer to our borders. We have seen the gradual invasion of NATO into Ukrainian territory with its infrastructure, with its instructors, with supplies of defensive and offensive weapons. That brought us to the red line. That brought us to the situation when we couldn't tolerate it anymore.
Well, the spokesman said that Western governments failed to fulfill their promise not to expand eastward. Peskov says that that's why Moscow wants relevant binding guarantees. The spokesman warned that NATO's expansion to former Soviet states bordering Russia is a real threat, both for that country and the whole European security structure. He also warned that Russia is ready to take counteractions in case NATO continues its deployment in Ukraine. Now, Peskov's comments came after the U.S. once again accused Russia of trying to invade Ukraine and threatened it with sanctions.
What we have laid out is a very clear message to the Russians, and we've done so in concert and unison with our allies, that if they do further invade Ukraine, there will be severe economic consequences and a price to pay.
Jake Sullivan says that the U.S. and its allies will give an appropriate response if Moscow is confirmed to have been behind recent cyber attacks on Ukraine. On the other side, Russian officials demand written responses to security proposals they've offered to the U.S. and NATO. Moscow wants guarantees that NATO's eastward expansion will be stopped and troops and military hardware will be removed from areas close to its borders. Russia also rejects the West's claims about its intentions to attack Ukraine. It says its troop movement along the border is to ensure its security in the face of NATO's advances. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
هم زندگی این مرد سرتاپا برکت شد، هم شهادت او. ما در زیارت ائمه علیهم السلام عرض میکنیم که فقبضک الیه باختیاره و الزم عدوک الحجه.
Both the life and martyrdom of this man was imbued with blessings. When reading a ziyara and sending your salams to the imams, peace be upon them, we read, God seized your life at his will, and by doing so, he proved the propriety of your cause against the enemies. This means he took your life at this in the hands of God. But this seizure of life proved your cause against your enemies and the enemies of God. The same is true of this martyrdom. Well, lives are in the hands of God. Everyone leaves this life, and everyone does so in a different way. Shahid Soleimani too left this world, but the details of his martyrdom proved the legitimacy of his cause against the enemies and to all onlookers.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
یعنی با هدف با عهد الهی با آرمان ها برخورد صادقانه داشته باشه. مشکل ما اینه دیگه. ما در موارد زیادی مشکل ما اینجاست که پای صدق در حرکت ما و در تعامل ما با آرمان های اسلام و انقلاب میلنگه.
Well, what does "of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they made with Allah" mean? It means being truthful in one's treatment of one's goals, one's covenant with God, and one's ideals. This is the problem we have. In many cases, our problem is that our feet tremble when it comes to being truthful in our moves and our treatment of the ideals of Islam in the revolution. But this man worked honestly throughout his life in the real sense of the word, as far as we saw and knew him in this life. This was true during the sacred defense, after that, and when he took on the responsibility of the Quds force. Working honestly means tolerating the tribulations of struggling on the path of ideals.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, our program aims to address the most important issues making headlines in the subcontinent and beyond, which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will try to explain the issues, break down the controversies and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Muslim women in BJP-ruled India are being degraded and dehumanized through online auctioning. And we shall look at the latest move by the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi to alter Indian-controlled Kashmir's demographic character.
Under the Hindu nationalist BJP government in India, Muslims have been pushed to the margin, denied basic rights, and at times punished for asserting their identity. Today, members of the minority community live in perpetual fear. They have become strangers in their own land. In recent months, Muslim women have also woken up to this harsh reality. Brazen attempts have been made to degrade and dehumanize women through online auctioning, triggering outrage and leaving the government embarrassed.
On January 1st, after the world rang in the new year with celebratory fireworks, many Muslim women in India woke up to see themselves being auctioned online. It was the worst possible start to 2022 for them. Their pictures were posted on an app called Balibay, hosted by the GitHub platform, accompanied by derogatory comments. Most of these 100-plus Muslim women were prominent journalists, educators, authors and activists. Users who logged in were shown doctored images of women with the tagline, "Your Balibay of the Day." It bore an uncanny similarity to another online controversy called Sally Deals 6 months ago. In Sally Deals, more than 80 Muslim Indian women were put up for sale. Both Bali and Sali are derogatory words used to demean Muslim Indian women in local slang. Although no real sale took place, the auction smacked of the lampooning of Muslim women, brazen audacity of the people involved, and sheer callousness of the concerned authorities. Importantly, most of these women have been vocal about the marginalization of Muslims amid the rising tide of Hindu nationalism in BJP-ruled India. In last 6 months, since the first controversy erupted, no suspects have been questioned and no arrests have been made, pointing to tacit complicity.
Photographs of more than 100 Muslim Indian women auctioned on the Balibay app include a prominent film actress, the spouse of a high court judge, the mother of a missing student, a well-known author, journalist and activist from across the country. Unlike 6 months ago, this time many women have broken the silence and filed police complaints against the perpetrators. The controversy has stirred up political tensions as well, with the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party facing intense scrutiny for creating a climate of fear for Muslims.
The fake Balibay auction drew anger and outrage across India after several Muslim women featured on the app made stunning revelations on social media. Many came forward to speak to media, while some filed official police complaints against those involved in the scandal. Ismat Ara, a New Delhi-based journalist, whose complaint prompted the Delhi police to file an initial charge sheet in the case, told media that it had been happening repeatedly with vocal Muslim women who highlight issues that people don't want to talk about. Her complaint encouraged other women to speak up as they found their photographs on the app. Quratul Ain Rehbar, a Kashmiri journalist who had reported on Sally Deals July last year, expressed her outrage and disgust in media interviews after she found her pictures on the app. Fatima Zohra Khan, a Mumbai-based lawyer whose name featured in both Sally and Balibay deals, had filed a complaint with Mumbai police last year, but apparently nothing came out of it. This time, however, a series of complaints and growing anger on social media has forced the Indian police to arrest four people involved in the scandal, including a 20-year-old man dubbed as their main conspirator. Whether the law will take its own course or not remains to be seen.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Idrisa Pandit, researcher and lecturer on anti-Muslim racism and gender justice. Welcome to the program, Mrs. Pandit. As we've seen recently, Muslim women in India are being degraded, dehumanized, and humiliated through online auctions. Can you tell us what is happening here?
Well, first of all, thank you for your invitation and hello to everybody who is listening. I think your question is very specific to Indian Muslim women, but you cannot talk about Indian Muslim women without putting it in the larger context of what is happening to Muslims generally in India. So the call that you are referring to was issued the night before we embarked on a new year, and 2 days prior to the call of auctioning Muslim women online, You have to realize that there was an open call for genocide of more than 220 million Muslims living in India that was publicly made by the supporters of the Hindutva ideology, an ideology that is calling for a Hindu Rashtra or a Hindu nation that is completely erasing the existence of other minorities, but primarily Muslims. This call was a genocidal call for erasing and committing acts of genocide against the Muslims of India. So it's in that context, the next step was the dehumanization, sexualization, and demonization of the Muslim women. And I think, again, it is extremely important to remember that this is not a one-off thing. This is not the first time that this has happened. There is a pattern to this auctioning of Indian Muslim women online. It has been done earlier as well. To answer your question, it's not just a frenzy. It is a deep cause for concern for anyone that advocates for human rights, because the larger issue of the rising right-wing ideology of Hindutva in India should certainly be a concern for anyone who cares for human rights.
Now, there have been two such online auctions in the last 6 months with prominent Muslim women being put up for sale. Why did the government fail to take swift action on this matter?
Well, the government is not just failing. The government is failing to even recognize that this is an issue. When a government is party to the very same calls for genocide of Muslims and other minorities, that tells you something about how they are a hand in glove with those who are making such calls. So, a call for erasure of Muslims and attack on the Muslims has been going on in various forms for a very long time, and particularly heightened ever since 2014, after the BJP came into power. So to just think that this is a sudden thing, it's not true. You know, it's been going on, and people who are members of the political party, as well as serving in positions as ministers, have gone off and, you know, participated in creating hatred and bigotry and asking for targeted attacks against Muslims. So when you say, why is the government not really protecting anyone? The point is, the government has been absolutely silent, including the Prime Minister of India, who's been absolutely silent as all of this has been unfolding. So you cannot, you know, expect people to get any answers when you know that the system itself is involved in perpetuating the problem.
Now let's continue with the questions. Many of these women have been vocal about the Hindu nationalist BJP government's anti-Muslim policies. Now, do you think this could be politically motivated?
So again, we cannot take this as a one-off thing. This has to be contextualized. This is not an issue of women who are just criticizing the BJP party and so on. You have to understand we're talking about prevalent Islamophobia in India, the anti-Muslim racism that is existent in India currently, and, you know, has been, unfortunately, been perpetuated in the last several years. So you cannot talk about this as being just a typical sexist attack, just like attacking women or categorizing it as misogyny. It is much more than that. I mean, yes, misogyny might be the underlying thing, but it is pure hate for people who, or particularly in this case, women who identify themselves as Muslim. And women that are vocal advocates and writers and thinkers and speakers on issues of injustice. So when you auction these women and you dehumanize and demonize these women, it's a tactic for silencing them. So, or creating this atmosphere of fear, because, you know, when you target somebody and you do that online, all sorts of crazies get involved. I mean, you have to understand and read about the individual stories of these 100 women that have been targeted. What sort of targeting takes place? You know, what materials they receive? There are threats to their life. So it's just being used as one another tool to intimidate them and silence them and humiliate them. But it needs to be viewed in the larger context of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism that is heightened and escalated in India currently.
There you have it, Mrs. Idrisa Pandit from Ontario, Canada. So glad to have you on the program. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Indian journalist Shyam Mira Singh says he wants to apologize to all Muslim women in India on behalf of Hindus for what he terms cowardly acts by some Hindu extremists. Dr. Amina Kandasamy, a British Indian author and poet, blames police inaction for continued online harassment of Muslim women in India. She calls it a mix of Islamophobia and misogyny. New Delhi-based journalist and activist Ismat Ara, whose photos too featured in the auction, says it's sad that as a Muslim woman, she has to start the new year with a sense of fear and disgust.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Narendra Modi-led government's controversial measures in Indian-controlled Kashmir continue unabated, further widening the trust deficit between New Delhi and the people in the troubled Himalayan Valley. In the latest move, that again stirred up a hornet's nest, a series of real estate MOUs were signed to attract outside investments in the region. While Indian authorities hailed it as, quote, a historical transformation, parties in Kashmir across the political and ideological spectrum slammed the move as an attempt to alter the region's demographic character.
Development journey. My heartiest welcome to...
On December 27th, a total of 39 MOUs worth INR 18,900 crore were signed at the Jammu and Kashmir Real Estate Summit, the first of its kind summit in the region.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, a historic moment today.
The MOUs are related to the residential sector, commercial projects, hospitality, infrastructure, finance, film and entertainment. While Indian authorities in Jammu and Kashmir have termed the signing of MOUs a historical transformation, political parties in Kashmir, affiliated to both pro-India and pro-freedom camps, view it as part of Narendra Modi government's project to change the region's demography. People's Democratic Party chief and former Jammu and Kashmir chief minister Mehbooba Mufti denounced the summit as brazen loot aimed at annihilating the identity of the Muslim-majority region. Her party spokesman said it was the beginning of a process to disempower and disenfranchise the people of Kashmir. National Conference leader and former Chief Minister Omar Abdullah also slammed the move, saying it revealed the true intentions of India to put the Union Territory on sale. A spokesman for Indian National Congress said the party would resist the bid to undermine the rights of Kashmiris. Huriyat Conference, a conglomerate of pro-freedom groups in the region, called it a step towards demographic change and disempowerment of Kashmiris in a bid to prevent the settlement of Kashmir's long-standing political dispute.
The process to alter the Muslim-majority region's demographic character gained momentum 2 years ago when the Hindu nationalist BJP government in New Delhi revoked Kashmir's semi-autonomous status. The move, choreographed to integrate the disputed region into the Indian Union, sparked outcry both at home and abroad, where the Narendra Modi government stood unfazed. In the middle of the pandemic last year, it passed a controversial domicile law that marked a giant leap in the mendacious project of demography change. The latest move is seen as a follow-up to that.
The move to put Kashmir on sale by the BJP-led government in New Delhi has revived a dark chapter in the region's turbulent history. Under the controversial Treaty of Amritsar in March 1846, the British had sold Kashmir to Gulab Singh, the Dogra chieftain whose family ruled the region for one century, for 75 lakh Nanak Shahi rupees, a local currency. It set a dangerous precedent, which is being repeated now. Under the present political dispensation in New Delhi, Kashmir has been battling against all odds to preserve its Muslim-majority character. The battle became particularly intense 2 years ago when the BJP government revoked the region's special status by abrogating Article 370 and Article 35A. Article 35A allowed only Kashmir's permanent residents to own property. Its abrogation was seen as a recipe for disaster. In July 2020, New Delhi used COVID-19 lockdown to pass a controversial domicile law, which constituted a big step toward changing the demography of the Muslim-majority region. It allowed outsiders to claim jobs or even residency in Kashmir, which naturally irked Muslim Kashmiris. The latest move of inviting outside investors, analysts believe, is yet another key step toward changing Kashmir's demography and eliminating the possibility of a future anti-India referendum.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Muzammil Ayub Takur, the president of World Kashmir Freedom Movement in London. First of all, thank you for the interview, Mr. Takur. Let's begin with the Indian government's recent real estate summit on Jammu and Kashmir, which has stirred up a hornet's nest. What do you make of it?
I think the hornet's nest was already stirred long ago when the BJP government came into power. They have a particular agenda, and they know exactly what they're doing, and they've openly said it. It's been in their manifesto for years. They want to create a pan-Hindu nation, and Kashmir is one of the first projects that they have. Settler colonialism and demographic change is a real thing happening inside Kashmir, and we've seen the beginnings of that recently. But we're also going to see further forms of not only just violence, but the perpetual denial of the people's rights inside Kashmir.
Mr. Takur, the People's Democratic Party has called it brazen loot. National Conference says Kashmir has been put on sale. Hurriyat Conference believes it's a move to disempower Kashmiris. Now, are these fears legitimate?
I think before we discuss whether the fears are legitimate or not, I think the first thing that we need to talk about is the fact that the National Conference and the PDP have no representative. They do not represent, never have represented the people inside Indian-occupied Kashmir, nor have they ever represented the sentiments inside Indian-occupied Kashmir. The reality is that these people have played puppet to the regimes inside New Delhi, be it the Congress or the BJP. They've always been their puppets with, you know, the strings being pulled by New Delhi. The reality is that the National Conference and the PDP have now had those strings cut, and they still want to play in the theater that India is manufacturing. That is the one reality. On the other side, the All Parties Hurriyat Conference are the legitimate representatives of the sentiments inside Indian-occupied Kashmir. We never generally keep those two entities together. And the reason for that is that the All Parties Hurriyat Conference wants the emancipation of occupation from India, whereas the National Conference and the PDP simply want to remain in power. They want to remain relevant. Although that they may be speaking the same language right now, that there is a plan to loot Kashmir, there is a plan to eradicate Kashmir and Kashmiris, the reality is that the people in the National Conference and the PDP simply want to be at the helm of affairs. They want to maintain their power, their protocol with New Delhi, whereas the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, although talking about exactly what India is doing inside Kashmir, they want to make sure that the narrative is set. They want to make sure that the narrative is not deterred nor diluted, that we want complete and utter freedom from India, despite whatever overtures India are perpetuating inside Kashmir.
Mr. Takur, there is a perception that the move is designed to alter the Muslim-majority region's demographic character and in turn eliminate the prospect of anti-India referendum in the future. What's your take on this?
It's an excellent point, because we've seen the way that Article 370 and 35A safeguarded the sovereign nature, or rather the special status of Kashmir. But even then, it's not something that we aspired for. It was a provision put in place until a settlement of Kashmir was made. By India revoking that and then downgrading Kashmir's status from a state to a union territory essentially means that any Indian can come into Kashmir, purchase land, live in Kashmir as a domicile, essentially being as equal to any Kashmiri Muslim. If that happens, which is happening now, they've started to flood these non-Kashmiris into Kashmir. When the local population is going to be diluted and an external alien population is going to be installed in Kashmir, the demographics are automatically going to be changed. And I have no doubt that at that point, India would be more than willing to hold a plebiscite or a referendum inside Kashmir. Once the locals are diluted or they've been thrown out of Kashmir, the foreigners that are going to be placed there, that are going to outnumber the locals, would of course vote for a BJP government, would of course vote for a referendum, they would vote to stay with India. So this is very real. Not only is India perpetuating demographic change and settler colonialism, they are going against the United Nations resolutions itself. They are going against the Geneva Convention. So these are not, it's not just about what is happening to the local population, it is about international law as well.
Last but not least, by not taking into confidence the pro-India political parties in Kashmir on such critical moves, do you think the BJP government in New Delhi could be playing with fire?
I think you're right that the BJP government is playing with fire, but it's fire that they've created themselves. It is in complete control in their hands. They know exactly what they're doing and what direction they're going to take it. The so-called mainstream inside Kashmir, the pro-Indian parties, at this point in time have no relevance. The Indian government in historically have created these people. They made them into heroes and they've made them into zeros as well. So whether they remain relevant or not, there will always be new people that India will install and create as new leaders, create as new so-called champions of the Kashmir cause.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Thakur for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Imran Khan, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, accuses New Delhi of brazenly violating the UNSC resolutions and committing war crimes by seeking to alter the status and demography of Kashmir. National Conference spokesman Imran Nabi Dar says his party will speak against what he calls the unconstitutional and unlawful acts by the Indian government in Kashmir. Gohar Gilani, a Kashmir-based journalist, quotes the head of Mission Statehood J&K as saying that India is bent on changing the Himalayan region's demography, history, identity and culture.
And that was our episode about Muslim women in India facing rampant online harassment and the Hindu nationalist government's sinister agenda to alter Kashmir's demographic character. Thank you, everyone. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his perfect progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Canon Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. As you have been following and listening such shows from IRIB English Radio, in this series of shows we are trying to talk about the questions and, let's say, the doubts and misconceptions that we are receiving from different questioners all around the world. For that, we have invited Islamic researcher and scholar Sheikh Nur Muhammad from Qom's Seminary Schools to the show to help us to answer the questions. Before asking the first question, I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him. Salam alaikum, Sheikh Nur. Welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day is that why Imam Ali alayhi salam never requested the land or the, let's say, property of Falak again while he was back to the power. Meaning that if it was the right of Lady Fatima salamu alayha, and everyone knew at that time that this was something that was gifted to Lady Fatima salamu alayha from her father, so why Imam alayhi salam never ever actually asked for that part of land, or let's say that piece or those pieces of land or properties again, and which were titled as Fadak. Before actually entering and diving into this discussion, I'd like you, Sheikh, to first introduce to us what Fadak was exactly and tell us how come that it was taken from Lady Fatima salamu alayha. And the questioner, inshallah, will find his answer at the, let's say, end of the series of questions, where we want to say that why Imam Ali Islam never ever again asked to take it back from the usurpers of that time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Talking about the Fadak, you see that actually after the Khaybar War, noble prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he of course could take the land of Fadak from some Jews over there without the participation of the Muslim soldiers. Mm-hmm. Okay, and of course it was a pure right of the noble prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. According to the verse of noble Quran, it was as an imam and as a leader and the prophet of the nation. And he has a complete and absolute authority on that specific land. And of course, it was, and because of that, it was a right of the noble prophet. And when the verse of noble Quran وآتذ القربى حقه was revealed, give the rights of your relatives and your progeny to them, noble prophet assigned it to be the property of Lady Fatima, peace and blessing of Allah be upon her. And of course, it is actually the rights of the noble Fatima, the daughter of the prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And because of that, you see that it was after the demise of the noble prophet, it was actually disputes between the debates between Lady Fatima, and it is famous. We have the Khutbah Fadakiyah, famous speech which has been entitled Fadakiyah, related to the story of Fadak to Lady Fatima, arguing against the caliphate system, why you confiscated my land. Mm-hmm. And of course, in that time, if you check the history, first caliph said that and quoted the only, actually he quoted a narration that he was only maybe the listener of that and the narrator of that narration, inna ma'ashara anbiya la nurith o na la nurith. He quoted that, I hear the noble prophet, I'm talking about the first caliph, he said, I hear the noble prophet said that we, the community of prophet, we do not give anything inheritance as an inheritance. Mm-hmm. Lady Fatima said that this is actually I'm quoting the gist of the story. He said that this is not a narration from my father, noble prophet. Actually, it is a fake narration. Because وَوَرِثَ سُلَيْمَانُ دَوُودِ, Sulaiman, one of the prophets of Allah, he inherited from his father David. Very and of course, we have many, many other verses of noble Quran. And Lady Fatima, in that argument, she said that, why do you claim that this narration and no anybody else, none of the companions of noble prophet heard and narrate such a fake narrations? And it is against the verses of noble Quran. You see that in that argument, please, I advise and I ask, of course, my listeners to go and check the khutbah of Lady Fatima in that time. It is very interesting. It contains a lot of Islamic points in that, and it is very beneficial for the listeners to study and to read such a speech of Lady Fatima.
Thank you very much for the information of the respected listeners. I want to say that Padak was an area 140 or 150 kilometers from Medina, and it was a very green area at that time, and even the climate there was moderate and actually good. So it was, as you said, after the Battle of Khaybar, it was given to the Holy Prophet, and the Holy Prophet actually gifted it to the Lady, Lady Fatima Salamu Alaiha. And even at that time, the population of Falak, the area that actually the whole area was populated with more than 20,000 people. So it means that it was a great area at that time, a big area.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Yes, but the question, Sheikh, is that why Imam Ali alayhi salam himself didn't ask again for that right to be back to Lady Fatima salamu alayha?
You see, because Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, first of all, he was following the tradition and the sunnah of Noble Prophet. You see that after the conquest of Mecca, Noble Prophet did not ask about one of his hosts. Actually, he was confiscated by some individual, and after the conquest of Mecca, Noble Prophet did not ask about that confiscated land or confiscated host. See, and it was a tradition of the Noble Prophet, and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam wanted to follow the Noble Prophet. And one of the narrators asked Imam Al-Kazim about this story. Why Imam Ali did not take back Badak while he was a caliph, of the Muslim, and he was in authority?
Yeah, look, Sheikh, the answer that you are providing us with the sunnah of the Prophet, that Imam Ali Islam acted upon that, is true. But here the right of a person is being violated, like that of Lady Fatima Salamu Alaiha. If Imam Ali Alayhi Salam wanted to look at Lady Fatima as a civilian, so her right was violated, and it was on Imam of the time to take this right back to the real owner of it.
You see, in that time, when Imam Ali was in authority, of course, when he was in a rulership of the Ummah, when he was asking, for example, for the land of Fadak, it caused a lot of people, how could understand this story? They would accuse Imam Ali to looking at the personal rights or family rights, okay? It was not acceptable for the leader such like Imam Ali to ask and to follow up the family rights. I'm talking about the perspective of the people, and they were considered to be a personal or family benefits of the Imam Ali, and Imam Ali avoided that. Imam Al-Kazim, they asked why Imam Ali didn't take back Fadak.
Was it asked from Imam Kazim?
Imam Al-Kazim, exactly, okay, yes. Okay. Imam said that لَأَنَّا أَهْلُ بَيْتٍ وَلِيُّنَا اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ لَا يَأْخُذُ لَنَا حُقُوقَنَا مِمَّنْ يَظْلِمُنَا إِلَّهُ. Briefly speaking, Imam said that we are the guardian of people, and we ask for the rights of people, and we take it back from the oppressors to the oppressed one when it is the right of people, because we are guardian of people. But when we talk about the right of ours as a family of the Noble Prophet and the pure progeny of Noble Prophet, the only guardian of us is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And He will take revenge or take right of our family of the Noble Prophet, and we do not ask for our rights. Okay?
Yeah.
إنما نحكم لهم ونأخذ حقوقهم ممن يظلمهم ولا نأخذ لأنفسنا. As I said, we ask for the rights of people and we take it back from the oppressors, but we do not ask our right from the oppressors, which